Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. I have a very special guest today. We have Marine retired Lieutenant Colonel Hal Kempfer and CEO. He is the CEO of Global Risk Intelligence Planning. Semper Fi, my friend, how are you this morning?
Good, Sherry. How are you?
I'm doing great, which is more than I can say for the people over in Ukraine. That's which is our topic today. It seems like the only people that don't know Putin invaded Ukraine are the people that live in Russia, because they're not allowed to listen to words like invasion or war crimes on TV, because whoever says those words is probably going to end up 15 years in prison. Kind of sad, but you know what? After we talked yesterday, I was looking at the map. I was like, okay, he took Crimea and nobody said anything. Belarus rolled over and played dead. Did he really think he was going to just stroll into Ukraine and take it and nobody was going to notice?
I think what he saw was, in 2014, he basically rolled in there and took Crimea, albeit they did it initially with a kind of surreptitious thing using this technique or tactic called Little Green Men, where they send in Russian troops, but they don't wear uniforms with Russian insignia. And then he did the took over that area in the Donbas region, where they use Russian separatists. But I think everyone assesses there's a lot of Russian military that are involved in that as well. And he got a foothold. And there were sanctions, but the sanctions really weren't that strong. Russia was still allowed to operate in the international economy. They're still doing banking. They're still selling things and everything else. I think what he thought was he was going to, he's had a run. He's had a run of doing things. He got away with it in Georgia in 2008, where he rolled in and took over the Ossetia region. He saw what he got away with in Chechnya, obviously. He had a run of doing a lot of different things, and I think what he thought was he's going to put this massive armored force on the border and, either force massive concessions, but obviously, his main plan was to just roll into Kyiv. His covert operators would decapitate the government. He put a puppet government in, and it would be, somewhat of a fait accompli within less than a week. It just did not work out that way. He completely underestimated, misunderstood the Ukrainian military, the Ukrainian people for that matter, and they have put up a fierce resistance. And the Ukrainians, they're not who they were 8 years ago. Whereas he's been touting this Russian improvement in their military, the Ukrainians have dramatically improved as well, with the U.S. playing a major role in that improvement, and you're seeing that play out on the battlefield.
Well, you have hats off to the people of Ukraine. They certainly have fought for their country, and, I just can't see some of these other areas. Why aren't you doing the same thing? Why didn't Belarus do that?
Well, the Belarus thing, brutally repressed by Lukashenko. It's a rather sad situation. That's really no longer a functional nation state. It's essentially been taken over by Russia. One of the things with Belarus that is kind of escaped notice because of what's happening in Ukraine. But in the lead up to surrounding Ukraine with all these armored forces, Putin and Russia ended up militarily occupying Belarus. They did this big exercise, but in some ways that exercise was a pretense for basically integrating the Belarus military into the Russian military. And so part of this thing is that Belarus has been absorbed within the Russian Federation without firing a shot. Lukashenko, he lost the last election. And, he's basically been holding on by brute force. And Putin is basically propping him up, keeping him in power. So the only way that Lukashenko could remain in any way, shape, or form in power was to essentially keep the title but give away the country. And so, unfortunately, Belarus is actually de facto part of the Russian Federation, even though it's technically a separate country. Functionally speaking, it's certainly from a national security standpoint, the division is pretty much melted away.
Do you think if they're successful in occupying Ukraine that they're going to stop there?
Well, that's another thing about Lukashenko is, he's an autocrat. He's kind of sloppy, too. He actually did a briefing, televised briefing for his generals, where he was talking about the invasion of Ukraine. And part of that is there's a picture that it shows him standing in front of the map. And interestingly, and it's probably a Russian map that he was allowed to brief. But if you look down the corner, you see the area of Odessa on the Black Sea. And they've got these red lines, which show the axes of attack that the Russians and the Belarusians will be using in the campaign. Well, it just happens that these red lines run right into Moldova next door, and you see an area of the map of Moldova that's shaded in red, and it's very clear from that map that their intent is to go into Moldova, definitely the areas of Moldova where you have a large ethnic Russian population. So this does not look like he's stopping there. Now, whether they would try and extend that up to try and recover the Baltic states, in their minds recover, which is Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, that's certainly within the logical construct or the language that Putin has used. That would be a clear inference, because the same language that he used 2 weeks ago on that Monday, where he basically said Ukraine is not a real nation state, it's not a real country, it's always been part of the Russian Federation. Well, that's the same language that he's used in the past to talk about other places like the Baltic states, which used to be part of the USSR and for a very long time were part of Russia, Imperial Russia. So obviously that's the big concern, particularly because those are NATO countries. We have a treaty obligation, Article 5 under the NATO treaty, that if he goes in and tries to do that, then we are at war with Russia.
It seems like the whole world is just watching this happen, and other than sanctions, nothing is being done about it. NATO or no NATO, why isn't somebody stopping this guy? He's just this little guy all by himself, like a little chihuahua. Why isn't somebody stopping him?
that's a very good analogy. I like that. The one thing he has, and it's not like he's been shy of bringing it up. It's often been that John McCain actually said, he described Russia, he says, it's a big gas station. And and it's true. If you look at Russia, what do they have? Well, they're not really an industrial power per se. In the Soviet Union, they kind of were. But the problem with the Soviet Union was, communism, I'm not going to get too political here, but from an economic standpoint, communism tends to reinforce the status quo. It can marshal resources, but it stifles innovation and it stifles development of new things. So communism inevitably leads to a very, pursuing yesterday's, it was a joke about a federal agency, it was like yesterday's technology tomorrow. But that's what communism does, is it tends to stifle. So if you look at the USSR in the 70s and 80s, it was becoming more and more antiquated in its industrial capacity. So when the Soviet Union fell in the early 90s, they had a very uneconomical industrial apparatus. And so most of that just either fell apart or was dismantled and sold for, scrap, because it just couldn't do anything. So what did they have? They had raw materials. They have a lot of gas. They have a lot of oil, I should say, and they have a lot of natural gas. And that's the biggest things they export. The other things they have is they have raw materials, for certain things like some metals. For example, palladium, which is needed for a lot of different things, to include catalytic converters. About 40% of the world's palladium comes out of Russia. Titanium is another area where they're huge. I think it's like 20-25% of the titanium. Boeing and Airbus, for example, are very dependent on Russian-sourced titanium. That comes out of Russia. Nickel. Now, they produce about 10, maybe a little bit more percent of the world's nickel. But in certain categories, for example, nickel going into rechargeable batteries made in Europe, it's a disproportionate number. I mean, a friend of mine in that industry said that European battery production is like 80% dependent, or 80% of the nickel they get actually is sourced from Russia, which goes to some of these issues dealing with NATO and Germany. Germany has, you know, Germany stopped using coal plants some time back. After Fukushima, the meltdown in Japan, they made a political decision to stop using nuclear power plants. That's a whole other discussion, but they decided to stop that. And they said, we're going to go to renewable energy. Very lofty goal, but dependent on rechargeable batteries to make that whole thing work. Well, in doing that, two things happened. Number one, in the interim, they became extremely dependent on Russian natural gas to provide power to keep Germany going until they made this transition. And then the transition is required on building these very large-scale utility-level batteries to store energy, which is sourced from Russian nickel. So Germany has a problem with sourcing, and Europe has a problem with that. But that's what Russia does, and that's all part of Putin's planning. He saw this window of opportunity with the reliance on what they produce in terms of natural resources, but that's it. So he's got natural resources, and then he threatens nuclear weapons. That's the other thing he has. And he's
what about chemical weapons? He's also threatened that.
He has. And, you know, chemical weapons are banned by international treaty. One of the things, for years, I was involved with doing a lot of what's called homeland defense, homeland security, running around the Pacific with our U.S. territories and countries where we have a special status of like Micronesia, Palau, Marshall Islands, where their homeland security and homeland defense or national defense issues are integrated with the U.S. And as part of that, I was working with a lot of people who were involved with the destruction of chemical weapons under the treaty, a lot of stuff done under the Cold War, where chemical and biological weapons after the Cold War, where chemical biological weapons were destroyed. They're not supposed to use them either, but as you saw, Syria, with Russians there, and what I saw yesterday with Russian, you know, certainly they reaffirmed that the Russians were very much involved with, you know, the planning, if you will, if not the execution of using chemical weapons by the Syrians in Syria, which has been the biggest violation of the chemical weapons ban. That, you know, they were using chemical weapons. You know, Russia certainly has chemical weapons. To make it worse, Putin has used chemical weapons. That Novichok nerve agent,
yeah.
You're getting into weapons of mass destruction, even though he did that in a very specific, you know, trying to assassinate people. So very, very concerned about that. And then, of course, this latest thing, which is, which we're putting out and everyone else is, that Russia intends to make up this fake story that the Ukrainians are using chemical weapons, which will obviously be another one of Putin's little semi-covert plots to use chemical weapons and try to blame it the Ukrainians. You know, one of the things I will say that we're doing probably better than I've ever seen us do it before is in this area of what we call information operations. Russia uses disinformation as a core component of what they do. They create a lie, create lies and lies and lies upon lies, and create these fake narratives. We've been picking up on this well in advance. We've been calling them out on it well in advance. And for the rest of the world, when he does these little orchestrated things to make it look, you know, where he says Ukraine attacked us or something, the only place that gets any traction is within Russia, where he has stopped all other media from covering what's going on. The rest of the world discount this. So we've actually been doing a much better job in that than we had, say, in years past. And so I give us some credit on that one.
Yeah, I heard that he's actually telling the Russian people that this war was caused by the United States.
Oh, he's just, yeah. You know, there is something. Soviets would do this, and Putin is an old KGB officer. And, you know, Soviets were rather famous. They create a narrative of whatever they want something to be, which usually has no relationship to the truth. And they keep saying it over and over again. It's very Orwellian. And with Putin, you can clearly see that this is so ingrained in his nature that this is what I want it to be, so I'm going to say this. This is the story I want to put out. And, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I'm sure someone would say that is, you know, if you look at his mindset, you know, it's really almost it comes from where he comes from, but lying like that, you know, making up stories like that to fit a narrative that he wants people to believe is just ingrained in his culture. I mean, ingrained in, I should say his culture, but ingrained in his psyche. And so that's what he does. He just puts these things out there. You know, the United States started this, the Ukrainians attacked us, so we had to respond. You know, this whole thing he's setting up where he's going to say, oh, they use chemical weapons, a weapon of mass destruction, trying to use our own language from Iraq and twisting it around to try and somehow fit the narrative of what he wants people to believe. And even within that, within Russia, there's only a certain segment of the Russian population that really buys this stuff. Those who are younger, who have been, you know, brought up with the internet, you know, as part of their lives and digital devices and stuff, a lot of them are still able to get information from the outside world. So it's those who actually, you know, turn on the evening news and watch Russian television and kind of rely on the official sources of information. They're the ones who are really buying this line.
The fake news.
The fake news.
Yeah, we have apparently in the last several years been inundated with a lot of fake news. And I think they call that malignant narcissism. But mm-hmm. What are you going to do? I heard they kidnapped the mayor of one of the towns over there. What could potentially happen? Are they going to release him? Or
I think they're just going to hold him. You know, it's an interesting thing. It is interesting because, you know, a lot of this, you know, in a war, let's just say in a war, passions run high, all right? And we talk about war crimes, and there are war crimes, but there are laws of war. My military career that was rather unusual that I ended up as part of that. I was in a unit. We didn't have a lawyer assigned to us at the time. So they sent me back to the Naval War College for a course on the law of war. And so I became the law of war expert. And that's always been an area of interest for me. There are rules under international conventions, like the Geneva Convention being one of the most famous, but also going back to The Hague. And there's other conventions that are out there. For example, there's a convention for the cluster bomb units. The cluster bombs the Russians have been using, well, there's actually an international treaty on that that bans those. And so could they take a mayor, detain a mayor or take him prisoner? Depends on what the mayor was doing. If the mayor was perceived by the Russians as part of the resistance under the law of war, they could probably detain that. You know, he would be a detained person. I don't know if they would, you know, I don't know if his role was such that he could be considered a combatant in any way, shape, or form. I don't think so. Obviously, President Zelensky has said this is a war crime. I'm not quite sure if detaining him would be considered a war crime per se. You know, you can detain civilians in wartime. That is allowed to do. Allowed conduct under war.
Well, he just walked out with them from the tape that we were shown. He just was walking with them. They had, you know, person on each side of him, but it wasn't like he was fighting them, trying to get away. It just went along.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if the Russians come in, you know, first thing they're going to do is they're going to remove all local Ukrainian government authorities. So I'm not quite sure if that's a war crime per se. Obviously, it's something we don't want to see happen. We'd like to see that not happening. But I'm just that one. I kind of look at that. And I'm kind of looking at it as, you know, in the larger context of did what Russia do in a broader context? Is that wrong? Yes. Could this be one of the things that are brought up in higher level war crimes tribunals later on? I think it's one of the things they would bring as evidence. But it's just one of the many things they've done. I don't consider that. I don't consider that any. Certainly, I don't consider that worse than some of the things they've done attacking hospitals and schools and other protected sites. I think that's going to be a much larger war crime that's brought up when this thing is all over.
Yeah, I was going to say he's done some pretty heinous things, and you know, attacking a hospital, I guess a birthing center, basically, with babies in there. And, oh, just the whole thing is just creepy. But he is a creepy person.
Those are illegal. That's a clear violation. You know, there's a lot of weapons. There's a lot of horrible weapons out there. You know, but attacking hospitals, that maternity ward that he essentially blew up, you know, at first you could sit there to a certain extent. I mean, there is collateral damage in wartime. All right. And lawyers that work this stuff, they get into, okay, was it primarily a military target where there were collateral damages? And then with certain weapons, you know, for example, the famous thermobaric bombs, the vacuum bombs, which is a fuel air explosive. Those, you know, they said that's a violation of international treaty. I've heard a number of news outlets say that. Well, actually, it's not. That is actually a legal weapon in wartime. We have fuel air explosives. We have used those. We've used a fuel air explosive. Very famously, the biggest conventional bomb ever dropped, or one of the biggest conventional bombs ever dropped, we used in Afghanistan against a cave and tunnel complex of terrorists over there. It is a legal weapon. It permeates the air with a vapor, a fuel air mixture, and then it ignites, and it creates tremendous overpressure. But it also sucks all the oxygen out of the air. Let's just say it's an extremely deadly weapon. All right, it's very damaging. In terms of how it's used, it has to be used against military targets. And there's some language that very much, if there's going to be civilians that are impacted by it, it is supposed to, you know, that it errs towards not using it, all right, to limit the amount, how that's used. That doesn't appear to be how the Russians are using it.
I was going to say, I don't think he cares. He's
trying to create casualties. And for Putin, civilians is just one of the big tools that he has for putting pressure on the Ukrainian government and resistance to capitulate. So rather than something that you're supposed to avoid doing, it's something that he within his mindset, that's just part of what he's trying to accomplish. You know, he thinks that's perfectly okay. Of course, he's never been judged. I mean, depending on how this war ends up, you know, if you know, the sanctions and everything we put on Russia, it's really not outside possibility that you would see a civil uprising in Moscow and other cities around Russia. I think, you know, over time, as the economy continues to spiral collapse, I would be surprised if you wouldn't see uprisings around Russia. So, you know, whether he ends up, you know, in the Hague, standing trial at the end of the war.
You really think he's going to go there?
I think you're going to have some civil unrest as the economy collapses, and particularly as people are watching their entire, as they watch everything they've accomplished in life disappear.
Yeah.
I just don't see his, I don't think he can maintain stability over the long run. I just, you know, and certainly we've seen Russia has, it's not, it's, I'm not, and the reason I say this is because they're already having problems. You saw right before the war, he had to send in Russian troops into a neighboring republic, Kazakhstan, to put down a civil uprising that was coming very, you know, if it had not been put down with the help of the Russians, might have overthrown the government there. And Belarus had civil uprising, and Moscow at one time had massive protests on the streets. And the only way he's been able to suppress that is through brutal authoritarian tactics.
Yeah, get your military to remove those people. The peaceful riots. So what if Putin declares martial law? What happens?
Well, if he declares martial law, I'd say functionally, I don't know if it makes much difference. The Duma, which is their parliament, is pretty much a rubber stamp. And I don't think there's anyone going to make strong protestations that this would upset the independence of the judiciary in Russia. All right. But what that would do is it would certainly remove the pretense that something is very wrong with Ukraine. Even for those who watch the evening news, the official news or read the officially approved media in Russia, a couple things are going to jump out to them. If he declares martial law, that says there's some exigent situation so dire that he had to declare martial law. That's got to get people wondering what that is, because it certainly doesn't fit the narrative of some little special military operation that he's been putting out about Ukraine. Because, you know,
yeah, he said it was a security thing. He was going in there to protect these people.
Yeah, and you don't, if you're doing that, why are you having to declare martial law? I mean,
exactly.
even for some of the most pro-Putin, they've got to be thinking something's a little off with that. The other thing is, and this may sound rather odd, but let me just say this. Russians love Big Macs, all right? They love McDonald's. They love their Starbucks. They love their Apple. They love their iPhones. They love, you know, Muscovites particularly. You know, they buy Western stuff. It's a huge status symbol, but it's also a part of their daily life. And with Starbucks and Apple and McDonald's and a lot of these big Western brands, strangely enough, Burger King is not pulled out. I don't know what the story is on that. But with all these Western brands shutting their stores and laying off, you know, tens of thousands of Russians whom they employ, that's got to be making them wonder. It's not just the U.S. There's other Western companies that have been doing the same thing. As they watch these Western brands, you know, the lights go dark, so to speak, on these retail outlets, but also watching these industrial cooperative industrial ventures being shut down as well. That has to permeate the mind of the average Russian, and certainly, you know, becomes very aware to those who we would call maybe the elites, those who are those who actually kind of run the company, our country, if you will, that something is very, very, very wrong, because it's unprecedented. Certainly since the start of Russia, the end of the Soviet Union, they've never seen anything even close to this.
Yeah.
And so even though he puts out this false narrative, at some point reality creeps into that false narrative. And, you know, with authoritarian states, the history of authoritarian states are when they fall quickly.
Yeah.
Everything's kind of stable and controlled until all of a sudden it's not. And in his mind, he's got to be thinking about what happened to, you know, Ceausescu in Romania,
right,
who'd been the dictator there forever. He's got to be thinking about, you know, obviously Gaddafi in Libya, and wondering if maybe that's his future as well.
Okay, you're going to stay with us, please. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. In case you just joined us, our guest today is the CEO of Global Risk Intelligence Planning, Lieutenant Colonel Hal Kempfer, who is Marine retired, and we've been talking about Ukraine. And what I would like to know, what would happen if Putin was taken out? I mean, you know, taken out.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that's not taken out to dinner, right?
Exactly. We're not going to Big Macs.
Right. Yeah. Well, you can't get a Big Mac now, so that takes that option right off the table. No Happy Meals for him. It's interesting. Obviously, there's multiple scenarios. One scenario is that the oligarchs, and that's actually part of what you're seeing with this pressure with seizing these mega yachts around the world, seizing these mansions, all these assets of the oligarchs, is to put overwhelming phenomenal pressure on the oligarchs who prop him up to see the end of their, basically see the end of their fortunes, the end of their way of doing business around the world, to put pressure on them to step in. And in typical Russian historical fashion, the idea is that they would orchestrate some sort of coup to have him removed. Now, whether he survives that coup is another story. I don't know. But I will say this. He's pretty canny about issues like this and security. You know, that thing where he stays 30 feet away from everybody.
I was going to say the table that's, the size of a football field.
Yeah, it looks like something from Hollywood with an Austin Powers movie where he's sitting at the end of this long table and stuff. And, part of that is that, he's a germaphobe. He doesn't want COVID, blah, blah, blah. Okay. That's a excuse.
That's more built.
A plausible excuse. The other side is, you got to remember, this guy's been sitting here plotting and planning and conducting assassination stuff in Russia and outside of Russia for decades. And he's a covert operations officer. And so as such, he's very familiar with the variety of ways that somebody can assassinate someone. And if you look at that, there's a lot of different ways that somebody could take somebody out, which tells me he may not completely trust all of those around him. Very fearful of that. Very fearful that, he's been using Novichok nerve agent. Maybe one of them could have something like that that they secreted into a setting. So he maintains physical distance from a lot of those around him. And I think part of that is to avoid a potential assassination thing. He also, I would imagine, has multiple layers of redundant security that, it would be very difficult to remove one of those layers. You compromise another layer to have a completely separate other layer right behind it that has a completely separate chain of command. And so his personal security, I think he's what we call a really hard target. He'd be tough for any coup plotter to get to. So I'm not quite sure they'd have to isolate him. Then of course the other fear is, would an isolated Putin seeing his demise and having control of the nuclear button or the nuclear trigger
go out with the bang.
Well, that's the fear.
Yeah.
And he actually said he'd moved his, for lack of a term, his girlfriend and either his child or children with her, it's not quite clear, into one of those hardened shelters to survive a nuclear attack. I think that may have been for dramatic effect more than anything else, to basically say, hey, look, I'm ready. And in case you think, I won't do it, let me just tell you what I did.
What about the countries that appear to be supporting what's going on, like North Korea? Mexico hasn't taken a stand. Cuba. What about these countries? Are they just not getting involved, or is there not getting involved making a statement to Putin?
Well, North Korea, I'm not surprised. When you look at countries like Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, Belarus, obviously, I don't think they are told how to vote on the international stage now. I'm not surprised. Mexico is a little bit of a head scratcher. A lot of quirky stuff with sometimes how they vote. Every once in a while, you run into some head scratchers. You're not quite sure why they're voting or saying what they're saying. There's a lot of, there are countries aligned. The interesting thing, though, is there's fewer countries aligned. One of the things that happened with honestly, I didn't realize that Russia was still as widely was still under most favored nation status as widely as it was. I was when that was announced, I had to go back and look. I go, really, that was all still in place to allow them to do that. I was a little stunned because I remember when that happened. But so much had changed. I thought that was one of the things that we'd curtailed a lot after 2014. Apparently, we had not curtailed it as much as I thought we had. But one of the things is that, we don't do it as much these days because there's so much free trade around the world. And that's something that over the last 30 years has been pushed as a mantra. All the free trade, you don't see the large tariff barriers that you used to see. Now, under the Trump administration, we started seeing some tariffs put into place to curtail, bad activity or bad policies and stuff by other countries, anti-competitive activities. China, for example, when they do things where it's clearly it's the Chinese, Chinese government doing anti-competitive activities on the global marketplace. We did that. Well, now this is a different situation where we're looking at Russia and what they're doing in Ukraine. And I would say we're looking a little bit further than that, too, because they've done the same thing in Georgia. But when we're looking at that and taking away this thing, there's some tools that we have that can curtail these other countries from aligning with Russia politically, but also, more importantly, economically. We're taking that away, which will lead to imposing either blocking, for example, with vodka and I'm assuming caviar and some other, some of the high end luxury things. We're blocking those things entirely from being imported.
And diamonds.
And diamonds.
Yeah, and Putin says that's actually these sanctions are an act of war.
Yeah, he says everything's an act of war. I think I was just reading something today. I've been I've been on the news a lot.
Yeah,
and it's that empty rhetoric stuff. He says everything's an act of war, but more substantively, the sanctions with this is it's not only going after the things they directly export, but the things they indirectly export. So if another country produces stuff that's reliant on Russian materials, I did some stuff. I was my unusual career, military career and stuff. I was working with customs for a long time. But you can take, we can look at content. What percentage of whatever product is coming into the U.S. that has certain content that was produced in other countries? So if they're taking raw material from Russia, and we assess that 10% of, for example, an imported car, and I'm just using that arbitrarily because I'm trying to think where we would import a car that was made with Russian material. But we could turn around and say that is going to hit huge tariffs because it comes from Russia. All of a sudden, we've changed the economics of how they produce that car, and we put pressure on that third country to find a different source of raw material or different source for semi-finished products to put into whatever they're trying to export to the United States or to other countries or any of the G7 countries, certainly, or any of the other countries that go along that are with us in this most favored nation status move. And so what that does is it puts pressure globally, containing, if I could use that term, Russia's ability to operate in the global marketplace. And that puts more and more pressure because all of a sudden, not only can't they directly export stuff, but they're going to have a tough time indirectly exporting it to countries that are kind of going along with what they're doing. There's a lot of tools there. And in the era of free trade, We've not used them like we used to use them way back when, but I think it's fair to say that times are changing very quickly.
There's also been concern, and I don't know if it's true or not. I heard that, you know, some white supremacists from America were emboldened by what's going on and traveling to Russia. What can Americans do to help watch for domestic terrorism and maybe some radical behavior? What would they do? How would they report this, and to whom?
Well, Sherry, you bring up a good point. There are neo-Nazi white supremacist groups in the U.S., some of whom have ties, definitely online, but actually much stronger than that, with Russian white supremacists. And you know, Ukraine has some white supremacists as well. In fact, you know, as much as, I mean, look, Putin puts out the same thing, you know, the Nazi government or neo-Nazi government of Ukraine, which is, everyone kind of, it's like neo-Nazi. The president, Zelensky, he's Jewish.
Exactly.
Where is this, you know, it's like, where's this coming from? You know, that's just something that's part of his kit bag of bold-faced lies. But if you go back historically, in World War II, and prior to World War II, to suppress Ukrainian nationalism, Stalin orchestrated a famine, killing millions of Ukrainians. It's one of the more horrific acts in history. He actually starved the Ukrainian people and killed millions of people in order to stop Ukrainian nationalism under the Soviet Union. It's horrific. When the Germans rolled in in World War II, initially, a lot of Ukrainians, it may not have been thrilled with the Germans, but they definitely were happy to see Stalin's folks out of there. And so a number of them collaborated with the Germans. Now, that quickly changed for the most part, although some did continue to collaborate with the Germans throughout the war. And so there were some, there were some that were neo-Nazis. There were some Ukrainians that became members of the SS. That's true. That was, you know, you saw that around all of Europe. You saw some of that where the Germans occupied areas. But he hearkens, you know, when Putin's doing that, he's trying to resurrect that era where the Ukrainians were, a lot of the Ukrainians were not anti-German or anti being invaded. But basically, they saw they were getting liberated from Stalin is what they saw. And so he points to that. Well, there are neo-Nazi elements in Ukraine. And this is something that is being watched very carefully. I know the FBI and others are looking at this very carefully, where there are neo-Nazis here in the U.S., like Atomwaffen, which is based in Texas, for example. They have ties over in that part of the world that they might send their American citizens might go over there to get, quote, combat training, combat experience, and then come back to the U.S. and apply those skills here. Interesting, this whole thing is something we saw with in a different context with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, where they would have people travel, foreign fighters, if you will, travel who are adamant, violent jihadists, for lack of a better term, that would go to get training and experience as combatants, and then they would come back to their home countries and do terrorist attacks. Well, that's the same thing we're seeing here. We're just seeing it with the white supremacist movement. That's a big fear with that. But I will say it's being watched. So what do people need to look for? Well, if you're, you know, first off, if your neighbor's flying a Russian flag, that's a clue, as we call it in the business. It's something a little off.
Red flag.
Yeah, but I would look for, you know, classic signs of white supremacist stuff. Just be aware of that. You know, and certainly if you catch wind that somebody is traveling to Russia, you know, or traveling over there, and you know that they're leaning that direction anyway, from language, symbology, whatever, I would definitely report that to the authorities. You can always call the FBI direct. You can go online. And they actually have a hotline, and you can report it. And the FBI watches this stuff. That doesn't mean they're going to just, you know, arrest somebody right away. There's a lot of, you know, the problem is there will be a few Americans that go over there that have those violent extremist beliefs, and that's what their goals and motivations are. There's a lot more Americans going over there who are just, you know, this is genuine, genuine heartfelt desire to assist the Ukrainian people.
Right.
And there's a lot of veterans going over there saying, hey, look, you know, what the Russians did is ethically, morally, everything wrong. I'm going to help the Ukrainians, and they're going into harm's way to help the Ukrainian people. Generally speaking, as U.S. policy, we're discouraging any Americans from going over there and getting involved with that war. That's always been longstanding that we discourage that. But there's Americans doing that. I saw a thing a few days ago that there's a whole bunch of Royal Marine Commandos from Great Britain who are going over there. We have U.S. veterans. You know, we got Army and Marines who are going over there to fight with them. There's a lot of Ukrainian Americans who are going back there because they're, you know,
it's their homeland,
their families. Yeah, I mean they're going to fight, and so yeah, you're seeing that. But yeah, if you see someone in that they are leaning towards violent extremists, you know,
white Putin supporter,
neo-Nazi stuff. Yeah, and then you hear that their travel plans include a trip to Moscow and then down to Kyiv. Well, that's an indicator, and, you know, let the authorities know because they're going to want to track them. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be able to, you know, not going to necessarily charge them with anything or whatever, but they will definitely want to know about it.
Keep
they're going
their
to
eyes
track
on them.
When they come. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, they want to track them in the same way they want to track somebody who was an ISIS or an Al-Qaeda supporter as well. Same sort of thinking. So.
Okay, I've had people ask me, why aren't we sending aircraft over to Poland if Poland's willing to give their aircraft to the Ukraine government? What's going on with that? We only have like 5 minutes left, so tell me.
I'll give you the quick one. All right, first off, that may change. That's the first thing I want to say. You know, that may change. I got to tell you that the political pressure on that may change. The fear is, and it really deals with, you know, it's not splitting hairs legally so much as what will Putin do, is if there's aircraft, military aircraft, flying from a NATO country into Ukrainian airspace, Putin could turn right around and say, well, that's it. NATO is now at war with us. Those aircraft could be unarmed and just flying and landing right outside the other side of the border. But the fact they flew into Ukrainian airspace, it would say Ukraine is part of Russia, therefore you're flying into Russian airspace, therefore it's a enemy aircraft from NATO coming to fight us. That's the legalistic political interpretation of that, and that's what they're trying to work around. I mean, you know, this really gets down to like, gee, could we find a way to land at an airport on the Polish side of the border and then tow that airplane into Ukraine so it could take off from a Ukrainian airport without flying into it? I mean, it really gets almost kind of silly like that, but that's actually some stuff that was talked about in World War II before the U.S. entered the war with helping Britain, was how do we get aircraft to Britain without entering the war? It was kind of an interesting thing.
What's the difference between sending aircraft over there or sending, you know, arms over there?
That's a really good question. And I will tell you, in Congress, they're asking that question too, which is, what's the difference? You know, the difference is the conveyance. If we were to send ships on the water or aircraft flying in the sky, the issue is that an incursion from a NATO country? Sneaking it across the border, we're doing that. That, you know, getting it into the country, and it's not really sneaking because it's the Ukrainian border, so we're not so much sneaking. We're transferring stuff across the border. That's where I'm seeing they're kind of going back. You know, what the White House is desperately trying to avoid and what NATO is trying to avoid is doing stuff that would inadvertently escalate this thing into being a direct conflict with Russia and NATO. And some of the, you know, hyperbole coming out of Putin, it's somewhat effective because it's got everybody very concerned that even if they do something that we would sit there and say that is not a violation, that he would turn around and say, we don't care, we're going to interpret it that way anyway. And so they're afraid that they're going to escalate this. And the same issue would be if we were to give a ship to Ukraine and it tried to sell into Odessa. They could make the same argument there. So that's a big concern. I think this is going to wind out over time. I mean, I think they could, you know, if I made this real quick, the other side too, as they're doing the math, is how much value does this bring? The concern is you fly the MiGs, they land at the airport, and you saw yesterday where they bombed all those Western airports,
right?
Those airfields.
Right.
That's making a statement. Putin saying, fine, fly the MiGs in, I'll blow up the airfield, and you'll lose half your MiGs. That's the point, which is they're concerned that, you know, he does have the ability to range those airfields, and he wanted to make that very clear yesterday, which is you land them doesn't mean you're going to be able to keep them. And then the other thing is all the support. It's not just the planes. It's everything it takes to keep those things flying in the air. So you got to bring them in. You got to maintain them. You got to arm them. You got to fuel them.
You need staff.
There's some logistics discussions on this too, which is how many of those planes will actually be able to fly on a regular basis? How many sorties will they be able to do? And what will those sorties, how much more value added for all the risks that we're taking with this? How much, you know, of escalating the war as a war between Russia and NATO, what value are these planes going to bring? And that's one that they are clearly grappling with. And NATO's been grappling with that as well. Poland looks a little different. Like, we just want to keep the Russians away from our border, period. We're just, you know.
Exactly.
But NATO and the U.S. looks at it a little bit more broadly. So.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on and clarifying a lot of this because, you know, it is confusing. And, you know, our hats off to the Ukrainian people. They are certainly digging their feet in and holding their ground. And thank God they have brave people over there. And thank you for your service.
Well, thank you, Sherry. And Sherry, thanks for having me on and give me a chance to talk about this. And so
we'll be talking to you soon. You take care.